To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
All right, you just heard the song, so you know what you're listening to. I'm Don.
This is Rook.
And we're here because of the complete summation of humanity's knowledge at our fingertips. We're not part of it, but we're there because of it.
Wow. That's
I
like that.
Internet. You know, I was listening to, there's a podcast called You're Not So Smart. And the guy, he wrote a book called You're Not So Smart. And it's interesting. In this one, he basically had a thing about algorithms and explained how they worked. And basically, he's talking about AI. But they had some woman talking at the end of the thing, and she brought up that another expert, but he said the internet must have been created by a bunch of old hippies. And I never heard that before. She was explaining about the decisions that were made. They weren't like, the human race has a tendency. When I say this, everybody, I think, 99.9% of the time want to be good, and they don't want to screw their other person over, even though you see it all the time. But most time, if you drop money, somebody's going to hand it to you. Somebody's going to try to help you out.
Yeah, you would
somebody's
hope.
Do the
yeah.
right thing. And I've, from my life, that's what I've seen. There are some people that will take advantage of it, and that's the ones you always remember. But they brought up that all the decisions made for the internet were basically good and equal for everybody. It wasn't a caste system, you know, or like exclusivity, like people want to do.
Yeah, at the birth of the internet, it was like that. Yes.
And, you know, now they're trying to make different layers and different people get more privileges higher up.
Yeah, which, the more you pay, the better bandwidth you get, or the more access. Yeah.
But, and that's the whole net neutrality thing. But I thought that was funny. The internet must have been created by old hippies. So thanks, even though that I think you did cause a lot of trouble for my parents' generation. I always thought you were beautiful.
Get a haircut, you hippie.
Yeah. When I was 5 years old, we moved to Denver, Colorado, and from Texas, a small city in Texas. And my dad's family came up, and at one point, my mom says, "Take them to see the hippies." I had no idea what we were talking about. So we drove downtown. And I saw the most beautiful people I'd ever seen. The colors, the hair, the clothes. It was just a bunch of young people walking around. But it was like it was like Wizard of Oz. We lived in a black and white world. And all of a sudden, here's these people in rainbow colors. And they all looked happy. You see people playing guitar, people talking. I remember we were at a light. And walking across the street was a group of kids. This one guy was wearing a buckskin jacket like Daniel Boone wore. He had dingo boots. And he had this blonde hair that was, he was growing out. It wasn't quite shoulder length, but the front of his hair was parted from the right, and it was just as long as the rest of his hair. And as he was talking to these people with him, he kept throwing his head back, throwing that hair back. And as soon as he'd throw it back, it'd fall right in his face. And I saw like 20 times going across the street throwing that hair back as he's talking to somebody. And all I thought was, I wish I was like that. And then my aunt goes, "These are hippies? What do they do?" And my mom goes, "They just look stupid." So, anyway. My parents hated you, but I loved you, and thanks for making the internet what it is. Anyway. Okay, speaking of all this stuff.
I'm dying to know how you make the connection now.
I'm going to do something completely unorthodox. I'm going to stop this episode.
Wait. Because this show never does unorthodox
stuff.
We're
by the numbers. I am going to show my favorite, one of my favorite writer-artists. Actually, I'm going to say he is my favorite writer-artist is Carl Barks. I love him. Everybody listening to the show knows I love him. I brought in a book, but I want Rook to read one story before we start. So I'm stopping now. All right, we're back. Rook has just read the backup story to Uncle Scrooge Adventures number 24 from Gladstone.
Magic Inc.
Magic Inc. Have you ever read, I'm going to ask again, I asked when you were off mic, have you ever read a Carl Barks story before that you know of?
That I can specifically point to? No, but I'm sure that I have. I'm sure that I have.
Carl Barks explained to you, Disney never gave credit to the people that did the comic books. It was always, and they wanted it to look like it was written by Walt Disney. Now, these stories were written mostly in the 50s. I know he wrote to the 60s, I think, maybe even up to 1970, but that's when it kind of ended. He wrote a multitude of stories, and I'd always read comics. I never read the Disney comics, per se. Friends of mine would have them sometimes, but when I was 9 years old, the next-door neighbors, the guy just got out of the Army, they were a young couple, they became friends of my parents. And one day, I walked over the house, and he had stacks of comics, and he gave them to me. He liked to read, and besides reading novels, he liked to read comic books. But he didn't keep them, so I inherited four large stacks of comics. I had Superman, I had Batman, I had Supergirl, I had Richie Rich. He had a lot of Harvey stuff, Casper, Friendly Ghost, Nightmare, Sergeant Rock, all the war stories, GI Combat, Star Spangled War stories, all this stuff, which my mom wasn't really thrilled that I was getting military comics, but nevertheless. And he had a lot of Disney comics. He read everything. And that's when I basically started I'd read comics, but I started saving them. But the Disney comics, at 9 years old, I was kind of looking at these are baby stuff, you know?
Yeah.
After I read all the other stuff I had that he gave me, I finally, just out of boredom, started reading the Disney stuff. Now, these were, at the time, it was, I think it was Walt Disney's Comics and Stories, is what they're calling it. The stories were okay. The artwork was okay, but there was always one story with Uncle Scrooge or Donald Duck that just stayed with me. I could tell, it was the first time I could distinguish an art style.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, oh, it's a story by the guy that draws really good, is what I called it. But besides drawing good, those stories were clever. The first one I remember reading was Donald Duck was a rainmaker. He had a plane, and he could sculpt clouds, and he could make it rain. And this one farmer came to him, and he said he basically had the dimensions of the area he wanted it to rain. Donald Duck took his little plane up, you know, propeller-driven plane up. He carved out a block for it to rain exactly where that was and got it to rain, seeded it, and it started raining. And I remember the farmer was standing there saying, that duck sure is a Jim Dandy. And then he looked at the reader, and he's pointing at his fence. And as the rain dropped and hit the fence, when it went halfway to the fence, the end was flat. And he pointed out that he went to my dimension so much, even the raindrops are flat where I didn't want them. And the story was just entertaining. It was neat. Of course, it turned into a big disaster, and Donald Duck destroyed the environment for that day, and he had to leave Duckburg. But I always call him the guy that drew really good. You'd buy a comic with four stories in it, and only one of them really made me want to. I was in high school when I went to the first comic shop I ever saw, and the guy that ran this comic, I went to the register with this, you know, some comics I was getting, and he said, this is your chance to get a really good book with four Carl Barks stories. Who's Carl Barks? And he said, oh, I grew up loving him. He's the guy that invented the Beagle Boys. He invented Uncle Scrooge. He invented Gyro Gearless. All the characters.
All those classic DuckTales characters that everybody loves.
And DuckTales is based off of Carl Barks' work quite well. But I didn't know that this guy did it all, but I said, what's his name again? Because I knew who he was talking about. It was the guy that draws really good.
The guy that draws really good.
And he said, Carl Barks. And then he showed me he had a button that said the Carl Barks Fan Club, and it was this unflattering cartoon of this guy wearing a Donald Duck hat and two giant hearing aids and glasses and, you know, a white mustache. And I always remembered his name after that. I never saw it credited, but this book had the Titanic ants and all this other stuff that, you know, Donald Doug did. Since then, I've always wished that they would make a series of nothing but, you know, Carl Barks' work. He did Donald Duck stories. Then he introduced Uncle Scrooge in them. Then Uncle Scrooge had his own series. He did the Gyro Gearless backup stories. He did 1 and 2 pages. He did so many stories, and Gladstone was putting these out in the early 90s. I got most, but the store I went to, sometimes there's holes in the collection, so I missed some, and I just ordered this online and got it. There's nobody like him. Anyway, I didn't make Rook read the main story, but the backup story I made him read. What did you think?
Oh, man, that... The ink that makes you pay your bills. That's wow. Right. That's pretty funny. And of course, you know, Donald's reaction to it is to just sell everything. Just sell everything.
Yeah, the magic ink. And in this story, Uncle Scrooge is rich. Just like the DuckTales cartoon, he's a miser. He doesn't like to spend money. And he lent Donald Duck money to go on vacation, and Donald Duck never paid him back. So you have this door-to-door salesman. Here's one thing I like about comic books. They show you things that don't happen anymore. And mm-hmm. even as a kid, you had door-to-door salesmen, but not like it was back then, I guess.
Now the closest thing you get to that salesman is if you're a doctor, you get a pharmacy rep. Pharmaceutical rep.
Yeah, that. Or phone solicitors, I guess. But. Yeah. But this guy came in and had this magic ink, and it says, whatever you write on it will make the people want to do it, which sounds far, but he said, I'll leave you the bottle, and you can try it. And Uncle Scrooge is looking, and he's got a free bottle of ink to use. And so he says, I'm going to put this to test. So he writes Donald a note asking him to send or pay him the money for that vacation. Then he disguises himself and calls Donald and says he acts like he's some professor wanting to hear about where he went on vacation. He'd like to learn. So, of course, Donald's excited. He comes over. Donald is showing him all the pictures and bragging about it. And he says something about, aren't you going to pay your uncle back? Oh, he's rich. He doesn't care. And yeah. He had no intention. Then he gets a telegram and he reads it. And it's a simple telegram. Please send the money. And then all of a sudden, Donald...
I feel ashamed. I have to pay this.
And he sells everything they have. Beds, clothes, television. And Uncle Scrooge is happy he got his money back. Then he goes to the money bin. The nephews are there. And they're like, well, Uncle Donald lost his mind. We don't have any place to sleep on. Well, when Uncle Scrooge is late, he doesn't show up, so they just leave him a note with that ink. Uncle Scrooge reads it, has the same reaction as Donald, buys everything to planet, and then the salesman shows up.
And he throws the bottle at him. Oh, man. That is something Scrooge McDuck would do.
Those stories, like I said, I bring this up all the time about some... I liked them because of artists. I wouldn't have enjoyed Carl Barks as much as somebody else would have drawn it, possibly. Mm-hmm. But I loved how he drew, but he was a great writer.
Yeah.
And the stories, he made you... I was reading... Stan Lee was talking about early Marvel Comics and how they went to other planets. You know, they went to places on Earth. It's where else to go? Another dimension! And which, again, was thrilling and neat, and I liked it. But that was a thing... You go underwater, you go to space, you go to another dimension, you know, you're going everywhere. Carl Barks, when I read his stories, it made me realize just how large and vast and unknown the world is. Mm-hmm. He would go to different countries. He would stay in Duckburg. And they did go to outer space. They did go underwater. But Carl Barks, he was in California. He'd been in Oregon, some of those places. He didn't really travel a lot. He did a lot of different things in his life. He was a lumberjack. He was a cattleman. You know, he ended up working as a cartoonist for Disney Animation.
Yeah. Will Eisner called him the Hans Christian Andersen of comic books.
And well said. That's absolutely.
And I can see why. After actually doing a little bit of Google work, yes, I have read stuff that he's written before. Not only that, but he's actually accredited he's actually credited for adapting the story of 8 episodes of DuckTales, the original DuckTales.
Right, right.
From back in, what, like the 1980s or 90s?
It was 87 when DuckTales came out.
Okay. All right. And several of these episodes, I remember them quite well.
when I say DuckTales, it was a great cartoon. I loved it. As a matter of fact, I've always wished I could get the first 5 episodes on tape. It was introduced everything.
Yeah.
And I did. I went with my daughter to Best Buy about a year ago, and they had the first 5 episodes on DVD for $5. And I really embarrassed my daughter because she could care less. She never watched DuckTales. She didn't really care for it. And I'm going through the store like Steve Martin would act, and it's like, I couldn't wait to pay for it. I was trying to tell her all about it, and she's like, no, just get this guy. Every time I'd show her the cover, she just...
See, I could see you doing that to her, then amping it up just for the embarrassment factor for her.
Well, yeah, sometimes I've done that, but this one, it was all real. It was all spaz real. But I'm surprised I didn't take my pants off and put them on my head as I went through the store. I was that excited. I really enjoyed it. It was a nice story. But even though Launchpad McQuack was unique to DuckTales, and Uncle Scrooge was actually a kinder uncle in the cartoon than he was in the comics, it was neat. It was a neat thing. And like I said, DuckTales had their own stories that were neat, but some of it were taken direct. Magician Dispel was Carl Barks' creation. In the comic book, she was terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, she was neat in the cartoon, but the comic books, she's nasty and scary. But the Carl Barks stories, I really liked the Gladstone. They were like the Asterix and Tintin volumes. I thought these things were going to stay in print, and you can see them in stores all over the time if you wanted one. Well, they said because of the sheer volume, they can't keep them in print. So when they ran out. You can still find them. They're a little more expensive, I found, than they were then, which weren't cheap anyway. But
I'm pretty sure I saw some for sale on Amazon here in my little attempt to Google things.
Well, again,
we have a Volume 1 and a Volume 2 showing up on Amazon here.
Well, now, Fantagraphics books started putting them out in hardcovers, which I think is nice. And what they did was they tried to take the original comic covering, coloring, and then some of it they kind of muted down, because, you know, computer colors.
Mm-hmm.
These were computer colors. And when I read about Fantagraphics coming out, they said that sometimes they were just kind of bad on newsprint.
Yeah.
Russ Cochran put them out in black and white, which is nice, but it's just black and white line work. And it says, then somebody put them out, and again, clown vomit comes up, that term we used last episode.
Yep.
I didn't find it clown vomit. I like these colors. They're vibrant, they're rich, they follow the colors that they used.
I thought the colors were pretty good.
Yeah, they are, and it was computer coloring.
Yeah, wow.
But they were good, but Fantagraphics tried to tone some of them down, because it is on nice paper and it's bright, but this is my favorite.
Yeah. Well, and what I find interesting here is, like with Huey, Dewey, and Louie, they alter the color of their hats, of course.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, like, artists will literally alter the color of the shirts as well, so that they're very distinct who you're dealing with.
They were that way in the cartoons.
Yeah.
The animated shorts was that way. Yeah. Carl Barks didn't. I don't know why, but it worked.
Yeah.
But Carl Barks thought it was a joke when some of the fans started writing to him.
Yeah.
He thought it was, I think it was Bob Foster, another Disney cartoonist. And he kept getting these letters, and he just kept ignoring them. And finally he thought, well, he wrote, and he says, I have a feeling this is my friend Bob Foster messing with me, but I'm going to make him happy and take the bait. And then he answered the questions. And then the guy wrote back, and it wasn't a joke.
Yeah,
and they had a club, and one of them was a guy. I think if I'm wrong, don't come find me in Florida and beat me up for being wrong. But I think it was a guy named Donald Ault, and he was a professor, a sociology professor at Berkeley University in California, and University of California in Berkeley. And he was getting the Carl Barks stories out, and having the students read them for sociology lessons. And but it was a bunch of a wide group of people in the 60s that basically set up a meeting with Karl Barks. And these books have all these stories. They have letters Karl Barks wrote. They have stories about why they did the covers they did. It was in depth. It was like getting a really awesome DVD set. And Karl Barks wasn't going to go to Berkeley. He said they were going to take a trip, but he wrote and told him, well, even though my wife and I are going up here, we're not going to stop in Berkeley. He says, the idea of sitting around a bunch of protesting hippies, it says, doesn't sound like a good time to either one of us. You got to remember, these were World War II generation people. You know, again, just like I just told you, my parents acted. And but for some reason, they did go. And they set up a thing at a hotel restaurant. I guess they had a banquet room and had a little banquet with him. The pictures are interesting because, you know, Karl Barks and his wife are white-haired elderly people with a bunch of people I just described that my parents saw. And they sat there, and one thing the people were disappointed in, because they were expecting a really kind of hip, wise, talking guy because they read the stories.
Yeah.
And here was this very quiet, slow-moving old man, and they said one thing they didn't understand was deep thinkers are usually quiet, introverted people. It was a big generation gap, and I can't stress the generation gap that my generation grew up in is different, because I thought it was normal. You had the World War II generation, and then you had the what they call the war babies that came after. Mm-hmm. And they'd have game shows and they talk about generation gap and cartoons, everything, television shows. But it was something that was there, and you always had adults going, what is this, rock and roll? You know, and it was like basically half the time they show monkeys with wigs playing guitars, and that's what they thought the young generation was. I started realizing there was something different when I moved here to Florida and I started working. I was 25, and there was a girl that was 19 years old that started working. And it's when the Beatles first came out on CD, and she got it, and she says, they're good. And I said, you didn't know that? Well, she said her parents were trying so hard to get her listen to the Beatles, and since it was a parent thing, she didn't want to touch it.
Of course not.
Well, that was something I couldn't grasp, was your parents are trying to get you to listen to the Beatles? My parents never would have. I say I love my parents. I learned a lot from my parents. But that's when I realized there was a generation gap that wasn't there anymore. She wasn't that much younger than I was. Her parents couldn't have been much younger than my parents, but it was a change. There's a book called The Good War by Studs Terkel, and it's an oral history of World War II. And there's one GI talking, it says, they had the long-haired kids in Germany. A lot of people don't talk about it. But they said they had them there. They were starting. I thought, really? I never would have thought Nazi Germany would have had, they call them swing boys. And then later on in the book, there's a German kid, and he was one of the swing boys, and he's talking about how they're protesting. They wouldn't let them in the Third Reich youth, Hitler youth.
Yep.
And it was jazz. It wasn't the rock and roll, but they were growing their hair out and doing all the things that my parents hated. but there was a massive culture shock that even though our generation gaps, basically the World War II generation went through unbelievably bad things and a lot of things, that it became a close-knit society that didn't have room for us that came later. We were always kind of outsiders, and of course, you know, because of all they did, we had a lot more free time and money than they did as youngsters, and it was a different world.
Yep.
Anyway, I'm going back to Karl Barks. As they spoke, they found out it was the same guy, and once they started getting the dialogue, it went on. I love those stories. The Fantagraphics books, you can get Uncle Scrooge comics, you can get Donald Duck comics through these. They're hardbacks, they're affordably priced. they're not putting them in order. The Gladstone stuff, they start from the very beginning, work all the way up to the end of it. So I like that, the chronological order. The Fantagraphics, they just put a book and it's just a mix of different stories from those times. Highly, highly recommend them. Got them on my reading list. Rook has read a story, so should you. Anyway.
That, is that how you're going to get people hooked now?
I hope
you're
so.
You're going to make me read one?
Well, like I said, the collection I have is Swiss Cheese. Most of it's finished, but Uncle Scrooge, that came later. And it was a wonderful comic store I went to. And the guy was getting them too. And the first series was I think it was Walt Disney's Comics of Stories, or it was Donald Duck Adventures. I can't remember what it was called, but I had them all. I think there's 51 of them, and I got every single one of them. And then nice. They put out six issues of or six copies of Gyro Gearloose, which I enjoyed. They had Uncle Scrooge 1 and 2 pagers. There's a couple of them. I got those. They had they had a few, and I got every one. But then when Uncle Scrooge came out, which to me was the crown jewel, he got me a couple, and then he didn't. And I said, "Am I getting these anymore?" Well, he said, "Well, I stopped getting them." He was getting them too. I said, "Why'd you stop?" "Well, I lost interest." "Well, I didn't." So he started ordering them. Man, they were hit and miss after that. I'd get one or two,
yeah,
and I wouldn't, and that's fine. But I have a list of them, and it's just locating them, and they're willing to part with the money. Anyway, I just bought one the other day and read it. I thought, that's all I want to do is buy more. And they're great. These guys, Carl Barks is like God in Europe. There's a company that, the Disney comics are huge in Holland, France, all these places. And they even have their own cartoonist. And for a while in the 70s, they published some of them for Mickey Mouse and stuff. Disney comics, I know they sound cliche or passe. Some of them were kind of saccharine and not really good, but Carl Barks, to me, he's right up there with Jack Kirby and Mobius, you know. As a matter of fact, I think he was my favorite artist. I think he was number three or number two.
Nice.
You know, right
nice.
Behind Mobius and Jack. Anyway, well, I've hung up most of the episodes. Let's have a music break and come back.
Oh, You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
All right, that was Moon Hooch, which I'm guessing is from New York. They're good, and I like them. Anyway, all right, we just finished talking about something I loved, and I'm here with a question. What is it that appeals to comics so much to you?
Good question.
Yeah, here's the question. Let me add a little bit more to it. When I love comics, I love the drawing, I love the form. You know, now whenever I draw, and I always read this about a lot of cartoonists that got really popular, they said when they were kids and drawing, they wanted to do comics. They said, but I wasn't doing comics, I was doing pinups. Which appeals, that's, you know, everybody's making their own characters. How many of us did that? It's fun. But basically, when you're actually doing your own comics, Dick Giordano in 1982 was in Dallas, Texas, and he was having people show his portfolios, looking for people. Everybody shows up with their portfolio. And he said, before he looked, he says, when I'm looking at portfolios, you may have a drawing of something you like, and it says, I may look at it and say, hey, I like this, it's nice, and I'm sure it's nice. He said, what I'm looking for is if you can tell a story. I'm looking for storytelling. And he explained why, how it worked. And, you know, a sequence telling a story, that's an art in itself. Whenever I was thinking, I was looking at composition of panels, I was looking at, you know, the drawing. Character design is a big one with me. Everybody's got something that they like. But when you think about comics, and you always talk about you like the form. An example. Everybody thinks I love the Marvel, you know, especially the Marvel movies. But the comic book movies, I like some. I love Superman, too. I love The Rocketeer.
Oh, The Rocketeer was on the other night. Oh,
yeah.
So good.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that no matter how many times I see it, I stop and watch it. If it's on TV, I have the DVD, I pop it in once in a while. But it's the form is what I love. And I say that I love animation. To me, comic books and animation has gone hand in hand. Dallas doesn't like animation, which it's fine, but it always kind of...
Dallas doesn't like all animation now. Now, let me...
No, that's not what he told me, but go ahead.
No, let me throw Dallas under the bus right now. He likes, the Transformers movie. The animated Transformers movie.
Oh, okay, the old one from the
80s. Dallas would watch the crap out of that.
Well, yeah,
so,
but see, I think...
he can't sit there and say he doesn't like animation.
Well, no, I do know he liked cartoons when he was a kid.
Yes.
So don't be wrong. And I know he likes the Charlie Brown specials and stuff. Those are animation, you know. Well, it's a different kind, but you know what I mean. But, you know, sometimes I'd have an animated movie or animated show I wanted to watch, and I really don't like animation, and that's fine, but to me, I love the whole gauntlet of it. But if you talk about comics, and you tell somebody, I mean, I understand art and story, and you like that, but what's the one thing that you really like about comics that appeals to you?
The escapism of it.
Really?
Yeah. If you put me to the test right now, and you have to, and you have to get an answer from me right now.
Yeah.
The chance to dive into a story and escape from whatever's going on, however long the comic is, however short the comic is, it's a chance to get away from whatever is happening and dive into a totally different world with totally different laws of physics, laws of behavior. Just, you can just disappear into that for a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. That's a good answer, and that's what I've always said. It's escapism. Everything's fantastic. The worlds are fantastic. It expands your own. I always said this. I always thank Jack Kirby for making everything. He expanded my imagination and my belief in what things could be done. He showed you different things. He took you to different things, and things I can never even conceive of, he had on paper, he put down. There's nothing more fun than flying people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
People living underwater, people going to space, alien. And we talk about all this stuff, all the cartoonists we liked that did some of these things. And I do love that, but you know, at the same time, they show that in the movies, you know,
yep.
You know, sometimes really well.
You know, with comic books, you have a chance to jump into a completely different atmosphere. No matter what's going on in your life, whether you're having a good time, a bad time, a hard time, These books, these stories, and any good writing should be able to do this. The fact that it's not just good writing, but it's also typically accompanied by good art.
Yeah.
It can on occasion be bad art and good writing, or good art and bad writing. All depends. You know, it gives you a chance to step away. You know,
yeah.
And at times you can actually find some very similar situations to your own life. I mean, why do the X-Men appeal to so many teenage readers?
Yeah.
Simply because the X-Men are a book about teenagers, you know, coming to power, changing in themselves and coming into a power that they don't quite understand. Teenagers very much through puberty, through coming into the rights to vote, the right to drive.
Mm.
These are very not similar to mutation powers, but these are very much, you know, similar concepts that teenagers can identify with.
Now, seeing that, and you know, I loved the X-Men before. The original X-Men wasn't that popular of a book, and and they were teenagers.
Yeah,
but the ones that put them over the top, the new X-Men, never seemed like teenagers to me. You know, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, Wolverine, you know?
No, but a lot of the stories, like, well, I mean, I grew up with X-Force. So
yeah.
X-Force had the teenagers, had the New Mutants in X-Force is really what like, Dallas and I grew up on. So we grew up with these young kids building their way up to becoming X-Men, you know? They had...
Right.
They had the chance to become something bigger than just X-Force and New Mutants, you know. So, and a lot of times with X-Men stories, you find that they are typically trying to help some young kid who is, you know, their X gene just activated and they're developing. So, you know, for teenagers, I can very much see that identifiable traits that can give you the escapism of dealing with that portion of your life. You know, with, like, let's take something like Batman for an example. As you grow older, you might start identifying with Batman because, you know, here's a man who learned to live his life without his parents.
Yeah.
You know, as you become older and you do lose those parental figures in your life, here's an opportunity to meet someone who, at a very young age, grew and became a powerful person without his parents. So there's somebody for you to look to and possibly learn some very unusual and damaging lessons, probably. But
you know, when you say that's a good point. When you say that, and everybody knows I love Batman, but somebody, it was on Facebook. If I can find a copy of it, I'll post it if I can find who did it. But it was drawn in a cartoon style, which I tend to like. But it basically showed the guy with the gun, Batman and his parents coming out of the movie theater.
Yep.
And it shows the father strike the gunman. And next thing you know, it shows they're gone. But then the panel shows the same thing, Bruce Wayne with his parents. But he's now a little boy. He's a little bit older. And they, I don't know. They're doing something. One of them is graduating. His parents are there. They're older.
Yeah.
Basically, and then it shows him with a baby or a little kid. And they're there. They're older. Basically shows his life with his parents. And then at the very bottom, it shows him with the parents dead. It breaks my heart. When I say I love Batman. And the guy... He was the main writer on the Batman, not Paul Dini. I can't think of his name. When the Batman Animated Series came out, he was talking. The name's on the tip of my tongue. It was Bruce Timm, Eric Radomski, and the other guy. Anyway, I'll post it on the blog. But he said a lot of people, when they draw Batman, they have young Bruce Wayne over his dead parents' body, and he's got his arms up in the air screaming, you know, in rage. He said, that's not correct. It's when they originally show the murderer running off, the parents are laying there dead, and the boy's on his knees staring at the gunman.
Yeah.
And he said, that's the way it is, because that's when the boy died and Batman appeared. He lost his childhood. And anyway, going back on the original subject, when I talk about this, one thing, and this is something I completely failed in on my own work. I always drew character designs, you know, panel designs, stuff like that. But I think about this a lot now. There's one thing, is sequence. This was a really popular thing in the early 80s. When I was in the Navy, Heavy Metal had it. Almost every guy on the ship bought this. Every comic store carried it. It's strips by, I think the artist is called Barb. But they're just sequence panels, and they're basically metamorphing. The view changes, the characters change. And most of them are images of naked ladies, which, again, made it really popular on the ship.
Oh, sure.
But this Heavy Metal ran some of this stuff, and they talked about it. And, again, bookstores had it. Every comic store on the planet in the early 80s had it. And you see guys get it, saying, oh, this is art. And it was. I ended up buying it. One thing that always kind of surprised me is I'll see 3 or 4 page panels, you know, people will do, and it shows a sequence. So sometimes it's two people talking, and there's a punchline at the end. It amazes me. But this kind of stuff, too, where it's just changing. Some of it's text, and again, it goes back to the naked ladies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was very Heavy Metal, you know.
Yeah. I don't think this was from Heavy Metal. But
no.
Heavy Metal, of course, talked about it. But that's one thing I've always enjoyed reading comics, was showing a change of time, showing a change of perspective, but telling a story using images.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that, whenever I did it, I've never once, you know, and when I do try to do this, it's really labored. I'm not really good at telling a story between panels over and over like that. But that's one of the things I've always enjoyed. Besides all the things you just talked about, I love the stories, I love the art, I love the characters. But when you get somebody, again, like Carl Barks, Jack Kirby, they can tell a story. Will Eisner, it's second to none, you know.
Will Eisner is just, that's the gold standard.
Yeah, it was. Saying that, I didn't really care for the work he did after The Spirit. I mean, I like some of it, but I know Dallas does, and I read it, and it's good, but it pales compared to the work he did in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah. It's, you know, everybody has their time, so.
But here's another one. 1984, I was in Japantown in San Francisco, California. And two guys I was with found this book. It's called Toro no Maki by Tiger Tatishi, I think. Taishi.
Oh, good grief, this is a book.
And I ended up buying it. Never heard of this guy. Still don't know who he is. But this is absolutely one of my favorite books.
Oh, it's all sequence art.
Yeah, and that's the thing I'm talking about. I'm starting to realize that sequences is something I really enjoyed, even though I've never played with. I've never done it in sketchbooks. I never tried to make. I always appreciate it when I see people make their own comics and they just draw stories. But this one, this guy plays with images. He tells sequences, but he also, the people in it know it's a comic, and they're breaking boundaries. They break off. They draw their own lines, and people can't get through them. Some can, some can't. They can take a line of an animal, pull it, and turn it into something else.
Yeah.
They play with shadow puppets, and then things come alive. They grab clouds, yank them, and turn them into some other kind of shape. Even break panels.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And like I said, it's published in Japanese, or it's a Japanese book, but it's no dialogue. A friend of mine, he had an exchange student. He had been an exchange student in Japan, and he brought a friend of his back, and the friend was homesick. And my brother lent him this book, and he read it, and he kept saying about how much it meant to him to have something from home. But he did say, this man actually, this is one of my favorites right there. He said, this man's not Japanese, even though it's a Japanese publication. So I'm guessing the guy's Chinese or Indonesian or something.
Hmm. Yeah, these are, I mean, some of these are freaking hilarious.
Yeah, and yeah. Clever.
Yeah, very, very clever. So.
You know, now we're talking about, all I'm thinking about is, I hope I can find some of this on the internet for the blog.
Yeah, you just have to take photographs, I guess.
I've never heard of this guy. Like I said, I bought this book. To me,
yeah,
that's possibly my favorite one in the whole book. It's just neat.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, there's different elements to it, but I don't know. I just find the interest, you know, why you want comics. Again, and it's one thing, and if you do this, it's more fine, but it always kind of bothered me when, especially in the 90s, when people would buy comic books and slab them and possibly not even read them, or buy them in a plastic bag and not want to open them. Saying that, There was one book, The Mighty Magnor, I talk about a lot. It had a pop-up cover, and I bought it. Of course, I opened it and popped it out.
Yeah.
But I thought it would be neat to have a copy that's never been opened. And I did find one in the dollar box, of all things.
Well, you know, I'm guilty of that with some books where I've bought them and I just simply left them. But I always buy two copies.
Well, that's it, but you still read one.
Yeah. I've talked about this before. The book Chew, how much I disliked the first issue. Well, I actually bought two issues of that. I actually bought the first two issues, and the first issue I found so dumb. I just found the story to be absolutely just irreverent. I mean, it had no purpose to me, you know. And I'm sorry. I know there's a huge fan base for that series, and like they were talking TV series at one time, but I absolutely found it to be like the worst. So I never ever read the second issue, which worked in my favor because I turned around and sold them for a ton of money.
Yeah, we talked about this before, and there's a kind of a history of Chew on this show. Before we started doing the show, when Dallas was always trying to badge me to do one. My daughter was going to college. I went up to see her, and they had a couple of really nice comic stores in town. They had several, but there was a few that I went to. One of them I thought was outstanding. I went there, and my daughter found the first trade for Chew.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter, she gets things that piques her interest. It's different, and
no, it was different. Yeah. It really was. I just found it pointless.
So while I'm in Tallahassee, she has me read it while I'm there. And I thought, this is a clever idea. I mean, when I say this wasn't a book I would have bought. But I really enjoyed it, and all I thought was, that's funny. The bird flu, you know, the guy can only eat beets. I know it's silly. We talked about this in an old episode. We're all laughing.
I'm rolling my eyes as he's saying this.
Yeah, but at the time when we talked about it, basically this guy, he has one of those things, whatever he eats, he knows the whole history. So if he's eating a hamburger, he sees the whole animal's life and going to the slaughterhouse and everything else, which is horrendous. But even vegetables, you know, fruits, he has the whole history. And the only thing he eats is beets. Because why?
Because they're bland and boring and he doesn't get visions from them.
Yeah, and that was funny. But the bird flu made a lot of poultry and stuff illegal. And they'd have cops going after people that were getting food.
They had poultry prohibition.
So they had these food speakeasies everywhere. I don't know. I know it's silly, but it was fun. And they had this kind of crazy guy that kept appearing out of nowhere that was agging this guy on. And he was an investigator that found this. And he had a very
He was from the FDA. From the
FDA. Food See? Drug Administration. You remember?
Yes, I remember it. I remember the book vividly. It's just dumb.
Well, saying this, it's fun to talk to Rook about, because even though he rolls his eyes and we start talking, he gets animated. I read the book, and all I kept thinking was, this is funny, and this is a neat idea. And, you know, when Y2K was going on, which is a completely forgotten thing, but every time people explained to me what Y2K, the company I worked for brought in a workforce from the existing workforce and outside contractors to straighten out Y2K. About a third of the company was people working on Y2K.
Really?
And the first time, a friend of mine, his brother, one of his brothers, was being hired by companies for the year 2000. I said, what's the year 2000 problem? It was before they started calling it Y2K. And he said, you know, explain the whole situation about computers don't have the four digits, it's the two digits, and it's going to switch over in the year 2000, and everything's going to stop. What?
God, I wish it would have.
Well, but, you know, everybody's going on about these post-apocalypse stories, and everybody's going to lose their money, and traffic lights are going to work, you know, dogs and cats are going to live together, you know, the whole nine yards.
Oh, yeah.
And, but like I said, companies were taking it serious, and management meetings, they'd have these engineers come in, and this one engineer said, you know, while I was working this, I thought, I got a VCR, I wonder what happened if I put the time, you know, the date ahead. So he put it at, you know, December, you know, 30th, 1999, and it crossed over, the thing stopped working. It's never worked since. Really. And, again, a lot of people run around with chickens with their heads cut off. All I thought was, you know, I wish I would have thought of this in the 80s. I could have done a comic book called Y2K. Of course, I wouldn't have come up with a name, but can you imagine doing a comic book called Y2K and telling this story? It would have been neat, of course.
Oh, it would have been brilliant.
But after the Y2K happened, mine would have had lizard creatures and people with swords and people with bat wings flying around. I would have made a whole awesome lizard army. And mutants, and underground people, and people that have kingdoms in the clouds, because the whole world destroyed because of short-sightedness by people that built computer hardware.
Have I ever told you the Y2K, I was at a New Year's Eve party?
No.
So, coming into the year 2000, at a New Year's Eve party, right? We're all 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we all paused and looked around for a minute, made sure the lights were still on. Like, hey, Happy New Year! And then all of a sudden, like a couple minutes later, the guy's computer went, bah!
Really?
We all froze, turned around and looked, and he goes, oh, it's done defragging.
Oh, there you go.
Amazing timing on the part of the computer, because it was like a minute or two after New Year's, yeah. And the computer made this, bah!
Okay, now, I'm trying to put in context, we're kind of making light of the Y2K thing, but that was kind of scary, and that was 19 years ago. That's still
I wasn't that scared.
That's kind
of. Of course, I was 20 years old, owned nothing, had nothing. So,
but like I said, nothing really occurred, and I always hear people say, "Well, it's because everybody did the job," and if that's so, rightly so. But none of the electronics in my house did anything. Everything was okay. I'm sure there would have been problems, and they took care of them, but it was really sad after that happened, and they let a quarter of the company go, and nobody noticed. You know, I'm sorry the people lost their jobs, but after they left, it's like, okay, it's still
the same.
Oh, yeah,
there were people making money hand over fist over Y2K.
It was, my daughter had a website. Somebody gave me software and said, I was trying to build a CD-ROM, you know, story. And somebody had the software they got when they bought a computer and said, do you want it? And I thought, well, maybe it'll help me build that. My daughter saw it. You know, she was, I think, first grade. She goes, what is this? And I told her. And she goes, can I build a website? Yeah, sure. So we took her drawings, made a website. It was fairly popular. And then the people that corresponded with her, she made a Christmas card. And she drew penguins with Santa hats on it. It says, Merry Christmas and Happy Y2K. Because to her, Y2K was a big thing, but to her, she put a positive spin on it.
Yep.
It must have worked because the world still kept moving. And we didn't have any bat wing people or flying lizards or people with swords.
Or poultry prohibition.
Oh, yeah, back to Chew. I really enjoyed it, and I was really looking forward to reading the other ones because I thought my daughter would like it and she'd get the other books. Well,
how the hell did we end up on this damn book again?
Not true. Anyway, she came back from college. She came home. First thing she said after I hugged her, she pulled it out of her backpack, says, "You can have it." "You don't like it?" "No." She was just, she's Rook's people. She thought the whole thing was stupid. Now, saying that, I enjoyed it. I was looking forward to reading the others. I have no intention on buying the book. I didn't like it enough to buy it, but I would have read the hell out of it if one of you guys did. And then when we all decided, you know, to do the book, the show, but Dallas got us all together. Later, one day, Dallas said, "You know, I need to start reading some new books. I think I'm going to read Chew." He was going to get that just to have something to read for the show.
Yeah.
So I gave him that trade my daughter gave because I didn't want it. Dallas read it and goes, "Well, I think I'll read something else." I still see it. I guess it's still going on.
I don't know.
And I'm saying that, if you like the book, good. I enjoyed it. If I was your friend and lived by you, I'd be reading your copies if you let me. I'm happy to see it being published. You can't like everything. But, again, it's a book that I remember with fondness. And I'm kind of hurt when Rook rolls his eyes and says it's dumb. Yeah, but sometimes dumb's okay.
Sometimes, you know? Dumb's okay, but I feel like it's kindergarten dumb.
I don't know. I didn't find a kindergarten dumb. Some of the stuff in it I found kind of unnerving, you know, but...
I'm not gonna go after this book again. I'm not doing this again. I'm just not doing this again. I refuse.
And this
I'm not
is
talking about this book.
This is one of the other things I love about comics is the passion and how you can do anything, regardless of what other people think. There's an audience for everything in it, and it's just a beautiful world. Anyway. all right, well, it's time and I gotta go pick up my dog. So you got anything else you'd like to add?
Give us a review on the iTunes. Join us on Facebook. Find me on Instagram. Instagram is the place where I post everything. You can hang out there with me. It's Rook Murphy, RookMurphy.
Or you can go to the sidebar of the blog and you see Rook's Instagram link right there under Buy These Guys.
Even better.
And if you are listening to this from something else, you can find us at bunchofdorks.com, bunchofdorks.com, and click on the Cyclops. Anyway, yeah, I've talked too much. I'm starting to think faster than I can speak. Anyway, and I can't believe nobody's still written us an iTunes review. You know, anyway, except for the 14 people that wrote them before. Thank you very much. All right, I guess that'll be it. Thanks for listening, everybody. In the meantime,
read more comics.